Well, thank you, Michael, for finding me a place in the program. And sorry, Carolina, for pushing you to finish in time. So what I want to show you is something that I started to do a few years ago now, work on melts from first principles calculations. What I will show you today are some results on the melts of the early Earth, the magma ocean. And this work is done in collaboration with experimentalists from Tokyo, from LC. Maxim Balmer helped me with all the geodynamical part. And thanks to CIDR, soon there will be a whole bunch of geochemists who recently started to be interested in mineral physics. So the method that I will use and that I will show you results from is first principles molecular dynamics. So for the non-mineral physicists in the room and behind the camera, first principles means that ab initio, it's the same thing but in different languages, English or Latin. Mm-hmm. And it means that we use the fundamental equations of quantum mechanics, like the Schrödinger equation, in a particular formalis of Kohn-Sham. Kohn is the cone from the Kohn building where we are here. Right? And then the result of solving these equations, this system of equations, is that we determine the energies and the wave functions, so the probability of existence of particles in space, self-consistently. There is no experimental input. So we have a set of equations, everything is solved self-consistently internally, and at the end we have the energies of our particles, electrons, nuclei, and so on, and their position and momenta in space. And then we apply this to, and we combine this method, we calculate forces existent between the atoms using this method, and then we combine it with Newtonian mechanics to see how the atoms, the molecules, move in time under the action of these forces. Right? So oftentimes you will hear this as FPMD, first principles molecular dynamics, or ab initio molecular dynamics. So some time ago I was asked by geochemists to explain them very easily what is density functional theory. So imagine that we start with five atoms, one carbon atom and four hydrogens. What we want to do in the density functional theory is to put these atoms together to form a molecule. And the theory will just help us rearrange the electronic charge, find how this electronic charge is rearranged to form the bonds and eventually to form the molecule. So you see that we start with individual atoms, we put them together, the charge will be redistributed, we have the hybridization, you have the interactions, and in the end you end up with a molecule. Going from the left side to the right side, we have a theory that is a function, is a functional of the electronic density. Hence the name density functional theory, DFT. And then once we know how the electrons are arranged in space and what is their energy, from there we can derive, at least in theory, all the physical properties of our material. In order to do this, we need somebody to sort out and to write down the equations, and somebody, the same person, somebody else, to implement that. Many of these physical properties have been already done, they already exist in the different codes that are available, but not all of them.
The picture in the upper right is the probability distribution of non-mineral electrons.
Yes, at like 90% electronic charge. So we use this DFT to calculate the forces, and then we apply these forces on our system of particles. So this comes from this website, which is highly educational. It's really very good. If you want to understand how molecular dynamics goes into a lot of details and very easy to understand with examples. So imagine that you start with a bunch of particles, a bunch of atoms, right, distributed in space, and they would move at a certain time. Each would have its own velocity. And what you want to do is to calculate first the forces that exist on every single atom because of the other atoms around. And then you have the velocity, the initial velocity, and the force that exists on the atoms. And the two combined will give you the trajectory that the atoms would follow under the action of these interatomic forces. And then what you will do, you will obtain these new vectors of displacement, and then you will just move your atoms along this displacement vectors. And you will move them typically with a space that the atoms would travel during a time that is on the order of the femtosecond. So that is milli, micro, nano, pico, femto. It's 10 to minus 15 of a second. Okay, and this is the time scale of the atomic vibrations in solids or in melts. And then once you displace them by this distance, well, you start all over again. You have new positions, new velocity, you recalculate the forces. And on and on and on for days and days.
So what do you mean by time scale of the atomic vibration?
So the atoms in a crystal are not fixed, right? They would always vibrate around equilibrium positions. So the pictures that you see in all the crystallography books with balls of atoms, they are completely incorrect, because they would be like idealized equilibrium positions. In reality, if you would be a small, very small, and get inside there and look at the atoms will just kind of move back and forth around these ideal positions. But at any given time, they will be slightly off. And this going back and forth and back and forth happens in a time that is on the order of the femtosecond. It's the inverse of the frequency of your Raman and infrared peaks that you measure in an experiment.
So the period of displacement from x, delta x, and back to x.
Yes, this is on the order of the femtosecond. Okay. Yes. Yes, Abby.
So in one of your first slides, I mean, you showed the DFT construction of AX4 molecule.
Right.
And so are you saying that you have to keep track of those atom vibrations, or do you start?
There was no vibration. There was no vibration there. What I do is that I take my atoms from here.
So my question is why, if you're going to be looking at liquids,
yes,
why don't you take the CH4s as a particle and then ask about their interaction?
Oh, because there would be molecules moving, but the molecules are not hard entities. The atoms inside the molecules move as well. The right thing to do is to calculate the movement of all the particles in all the molecules in your whole liquid. If you would look at your methane molecule, right, in a methane liquid,
right,
yes, from a crystallography perspective, you have a CH4 that is a unit like this.
Yeah.
But this unit at every single moment would be highly distorted. It's never an ideal
tetrahedron. The energetics of the distortion of that internal CH4, are they so different from the energetics of the assemblage of AX4 molecules that you can separate them?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
And you get that exactly because you calculate these forces acting on the atoms.
Well, I was thinking you could skip that part because the energetics of that are so different that you can just now deal with.
If you do that, it's not ab initio anymore. You do a liquid made out of rigid molecules. You can do that, but
not necessarily rigid, but they have some statistical properties.
Imagine that once you apply pressure, I will show you in a moment, your CO2 molecules will transform into CO3 groups. If you keep them as a CO2, you will never see what happens. You will never understand how the dynamics of the liquid happens. The SiO4, the tetrahedra, the SiO4 tetrahedra, under pressure, going to SiO5s and SiO6.
Right, you have to be able to calculate the changes in volume of your species.
Yeah. This is not fair that you're eating cookies on my nose.
She needs a brownie.
No, no, not packing.
Okay, so we combine forces that we obtain in first principles with all this dynamical approach based on Newtonian mechanics.
So the forces are all electrical.
Electronical, they are not electrical, because you have many interactions that I didn't want to share the formula, but to calculate the forces will be the derivatives of the energy with respect to the atomic position. Okay, and that energy is the sum of kinetical and potential energy. The potential energy has an electrostatic part of all the charged particles interacting, which is screened by the presence of these charges.
Yeah, but of the basic forces of...
It's all together. There are a lot of...
But gravity and strong and weak are not in here.
No, because we are talking about
Okay. No,
atomic level.
That's what I was...
Yes. So once you do first principles molecular dynamics, what you need to do, what you need, what is the most important part to do your FPMD?
The computer.
Yeah, you find computers. Matt would know that. You need patience. Because this takes days and days and weeks in order to get something. Because why? Because you need in all that FPMD runs to have enough statistics. So you have you need to have enough configurations, like picosecond order at least. If you want, and I will show you trajectories of particles to see how important that is. Right? If you want to do to calculate viscosity of the liquid, you need to go to the nanoseconds. So that means that you need millions of time steps. So this is why easily you go to the 6 months time scale for calculating the partitioning of helium. And this is why it's not yet done.
So it seems like this method is kind of begging for the analog of a refined mesh system, right? Like,
yes and no.
It's fine in places where there's instabilities in your particles, but then there might be regimes in which you don't have to worry about all of the motions.
There are, so for example, if you, I mean, we can talk about this maybe later because I really want to share the mass, but that would not work in the mass here because they are highly homogeneous. They would work for systems where you have a particle, a defect. You can use, instead of using wave functions, plane waves that go all over the space, you can use wavelets. They would work very well for interfaces, but you'll always have to take into account everything when you do this. There are methods to use like Gaussian orbitals, but they come with very strong limitations. And the advantage here is that you can go on hundreds of processors and then just wait. Yes, Michael.
So coming back to patience, does the uncertainty in all your properties scale like the square root of the number?
Yes, and the particles.
Statistics are normal statistics.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so then how we actually do this in practice? So one of the things I hear oftentimes is that we are like modeling the core with 100 atoms. Well, that is not true because we always work on an infinity of atoms. Like here, they go. There are no limits. So it's an ideal solid, an ideal box that is periodically repeated. It never stops. There are no boundaries. So actually, our simulation is always on an infinity of atoms. Now, of course, we don't do this in practice because otherwise I would still be upstairs waiting.
You would need a computer the size of the Earth.
It would never work. So what we do actually is that we look. We use the periodic boundary conditions. If you look closely, every single one of these boxes are always the same. And then we use that fact to actually reduce the amount of calculations that we do. We always take into account the interactions between all the particles and all the particles, but we manage to scale them off as we go to further and further distances. And then we focus on what happens in one particular box. And because it's periodic boundary condition, it means that if this would be a melt, as it would be in a moment, when an atom comes out on one side, it will enter in the next right box. It means that the same from here would enter again from one side. So you preserve the number of particles, right? Okay, so, and then, so how we will do, right? So we use this periodicity, use numerical techniques like FFTs, eval sums, and so on to get to reduce as much as possible the amount of calculations. Okay, and then in practice, how we do, we calculate the forces, we obtain velocities, we combine everything with Newton, and then so we go and calculate the new positions, and so on and so. So now let me show you how it looks like when you melt a crystal of iron. This is one of these, let's say, improved pictures from crystallography. Because this is a snapshot of how your crystal actually looks like. Your iron atoms here in a crystallography book would be all one on top of the other, like an ideal column. In reality, every single atom would be slightly displaced because they just vibrate, they go back and forth, spanning the whole vibrational spectrum. So at any single moment, an instantaneous picture would look like these atoms are slightly outside of their ideal positions. Okay, and then what we do is that we start with one of these configurations. I think that here there were 108 atoms in this box. This is again repeated periodically. Start from 0 Kelvin and heat it up. Heat it up, meaning that we add energy, kinetic energy, as temperature. At every time step here, we increase the temperature by 10 Kelvin, by 10 degrees. And then the atoms start to move. You see that in the beginning, they just go back and forth because this is the vibration, this is low temperature. But then as the temperature increases, the amplitude of these vibrations is larger and larger. So at the end, at high enough temperature, well beyond the melting point, you'll end up with something that is not a crystal anymore. And there would be a melt. You check that your atoms diffuse, so it's a liquid, a fluid, and they are not just doing this back and forth anymore. And then just looking at it, you see that this is not a crystal anymore. It melted. Okay, but the critical point to know that it's a fluid is that atoms diffuse.
Wait a minute. Atoms diffuse in solids, and that's not fluid.
Okay. The time scale.
A shear stability criterion?
Yeah, but it will be much easier, much faster to determine this from mean square displacements of the atoms. My God.
We look back to the beginning of this. I'm not quite sure what I'm looking at here. Since
right. So.
This seems very simple. I understand every atom.
Right. So this is an HCP crystal seen from the side. This is why it looks like a cube, like.
Why do we have three atoms all right?
Oh, because this is the whole column of atoms.
Oh, we're looking down.
We're looking down. Yeah. Right? So, imagine that you have. So, this was BCC probably. So, you start with. This is what. Okay? Because this would be like what your crystallography book tells you. But then, when you add more and more crystals, you will see this one and the atom here and the atom here. And each one of them is slightly off in a different way. Okay? This is why they're slightly around. And then, there was an instantaneous shot. And then when you add the temperature, you just put more energy, more kinetic energy on every single atom, distributed as like a Boltzmann distribution. Okay, and then your atoms will, because the vibration would be so large, eventually the bonds that keep the crystal together will break, and you'll end up with a fluid.
So I always think of that as being a phase transition.
Yeah, it is a. Yes.
And there's a link to the heat.
Yes.
And so if I watch this movie, it looks like everything is changing continuously.
Yes. Well, yeah, but, I mean, behind here, there were like 5,000 steps. Yeah. Right? And then continuously, meaning that I sample this every single femtosecond during 5 picoseconds to melt it.
But there is something that changes discontinuously.
From one. Right, right.
Is it true that it changes discontinuously, or is it actually continuous on this picoscale time scale, but when we see it in the lab, we see it as a discontinuous process?
Melt is a real phase transition.
Yes, yeah, melt is a real phase transition.
But is it instantaneous, or does it have a time scale?
Well, it should definitely have a time scale because you need the atoms to move away from the crystal, but then if you look at the latent heat, you would definitely see the jump. Yes.
And if you plot mean free path versus time, what would that curve look like?
Okay, well, so here I change the temperature, so I cannot do that. I should do that in a system where the temperature is constant. Here I don't conserve energy, I don't conserve temperature, I just want to melt it.
Right.
Okay, once it's molten, I can play and do these kind of things that you will see in a moment. But here, I'm just like obtaining a disordered structure that makes sense from a liquid point of view.
Does your box handle thermal expansion, or are you stuck with the same?
No, so this one here is an NV, so the volume is fixed. I could do that if I want to keep the pressure. It works, so that's an alternative.
Right, so the pressure increases.
So the pressure with here, exactly, the pressure will increase. And in what you will see in a moment, I did all these pyrolyte melts at the same volume every time, but at different temperatures, so the pressure is always shifted.
Right, but you can calculate the partition coefficient as a function of your step.
Partition of what?
The the statistical mechanical properties
yeah, absolutely,
of
yeah.
this, and then monitor it, and then take the derivative.
One second.
Okay.
So there was ION. So what I wanted to do, okay, so I have this all these simulations on ION, but what I wanted to show today is the pyrolite, the magma ocean. So we just take the whole mantle, we melt it, and we wanted to compare, to determine actually in the beginning, the density crossover in the magma ocean when it started to crystallize. All right, so the pyrolite, you know it even better than I do, that is a mixture of perovskite, what people call today bridgmanite, magnesioversite, and the calcium silicate-based perovskite. So I did a whole bunch of simulations as a function of pressure, temperature, and chemical evolution of the melt to determine the density. Because as Christelle would tell you, determining the density is very hard and very complicated, especially when you go to 5,000 Kelvin and megabar. Okay, so I could crystallize, to answer Hugh's question yesterday, I could crystallize my magma ocean, but it would take several decades of thermodynamics. Instead of doing that, I just asked Nomura-san and Hirose-san to tell me how the chemistry of the melt evolves during crystallization, because that took them a few months or a few years. So I start with a pyrolite, pure melt, no crystals, and then the experimentalists tell me how the chemical evolution changes with crystallization. So what they do is that they take the melt, they let it crystallize, and then they obtain 30% in volume crystals and 70% melt. The composition of this melt will change because you extract mainly magnesium silicate components, the perovskite. And then you keep on doing this, and when you're 50-50 is the moment when you start to extract magnesioversite, and where we stopped, because this also corresponds to the rheological transition. So we've done simulations at these three compositions over three isotherms. So how does this melt look like? So this is pyrolite, 0 GPA, 3000 Kelvin. This would be very much like lava coming from below and coming out on the surface, very hot, 3000 Kelvin. And you see that it's a multi-component system. The right way to do this would be to go on all this, every component space, and describe the melt in a six-dimensional space, and we will never finish because there are so many components and so many things to change. So instead of this, I just said, no, let's just take the pyrolite and look at its properties. So you see, for example, here that the silicon is coordinated fourfold by oxygens, to answer Abby's question from before, in most of the times. But these are not rigid molecules. So if you would describe them as rigid molecules, that's wrong, because you don't get all these interactions. You won't see how the atoms move around and what happens with the fluid. Okay, and then you see that here they are SiO4s, just like you would expect in a molten forsterite, in a molten olivine. Magnesium are very, just look at these atoms here, they are highly diffusive, right? So it's very hot, low pressure, there is a lot of diffusion. Magnesium would be one of the atoms that move the fastest around. Now, when you do this over, I don't remember, 20 or 30 picoseconds, okay, so I have like 20 or 30,000 snapshots behind, I can start to do all the statistics you want.
There doesn't seem to be any reason for the different sizes of the atoms.
No. No, I mean, that is like pure form.
Not at all.
No, they are not related. No. Actually, the size. No.
Yeah, all oxygen. Yeah.
The size of the atoms, if you really want to calculate it, and we did this with a student who graduated earlier this year on magnesium silicate melts, the size of the atoms is not spherical. The atoms are not spheres. It really depends how you define them. They have very weird shapes in reality. The charge changes continuously because of vibrations, of exchanges. So this picture, again, is highly idealized, just so we see where the atoms are. The reality is completely different.
What happened to potassium?
Well, I don't know what happens to potassium. Somewhere there in my mess. You don't have enough six components. Maybe it was so, I mean.
Oh, no, you mentioned potassium in the previous slide. I'm just wondering.
What was it?
It wasn't in the
No,
slide.
There was no. It was so. Yeah, okay, like potassium bearing, but there was like not enough potassium there to
to put it well.
So once you do these very long simulations, right, we can do the statistics, and this would be one of the first things we can do. We can see how many, so how at a given distance from a central atom, usually a cation, right, you would calculate how many oxygens you have at that particular distance. The peaks here will give you the distance of the SiO bond, the 1.72 in a silica crystal, would be slightly larger here because it's a male, because it's higher temperatures and so on. And you can do this for every single pair, anything you want, because you know every single particle in your system. Now I think that, and then if you FFT this, so if you do a Fourier transform, you would obtain what Christelle sees when she does the diffraction or the melt. Is that she would see all these things together, while we can have them pairs by pairs or sets of like classes by classes.
Is this spin polarized?
Yes.
And it's just surprising that the FeO bond distance is shorter than the NGO bond distance.
You, yes, this one. Yes. I don't know, but it is spin polarized.
It's a very small difference.
It's not a
spot,
yeah.
It's different from what we find. That's why.
What do you find?
This one and this one.
I have you along in this case.
Oh, but it's the same.
Yeah.
So there are the same conditions,
yeah.
But not chemistry.
Yeah, I mean, an MG.
MGFE
silicate
yes,
melt.
Yes.
FE upon log and MG.
Okay, I don't know. I should look at the other ones as well. I don't know what to say, but yes, it's spin polarized.
I think that's what we got too, yeah, when we got very pure magnesium, very pure FeO, we also see less losses, yeah.
It's maybe that there are so many things inside in this melt that they all sort of interact.
And actually, you also see two distributions for iron.
Because you would have Fe2 plus and Fe3 plus, probably.
No, because
no?
We checked with Ms. Bauer. It was
okay.
Also sent to Catherine. Which might not be relevant for nature, actually. But,
yes.
Yeah. But in the case of only iron 2 plus at zero GPA, we have two distances.
At 3000 Kelvin, because that's also critical. At 3000
yeah,
Kelvin,
yeah.
It's a lot of temperature,
we
much higher than what you have.
Yeah.
The nice thing that to do with this is to integrate them. So rather than just looking at the bond distance, would be just to see how many atoms you have around each cation. So if you do this, again, this is distance, this would be how many oxygens are around silicon. And then if you would do this till the first peak, you see you integrate this blue line up to this point, right, you would obtain the coordination number of silicon by oxygen. That would correspond to this flat region here, which is 4. At low pressures, Si is forming SiO4s, which is normal, what you would expect. And then the others are more continuous distribution. It's much harder to say that you have an MgO8 or MgO7 and so on. What I plotted here also is the coordination of oxygen by silicon. So this is the other way around. Because I calculate how many silicon atoms are bonded to every single oxygen. And when it's 1, it means that you have SiO4 tetrahedra that are independent. They don't stick to each other.
That's polymerization.
Because when you have an SiO4, you would have a silicon, and each oxygen would have only one silicon neighbor. Now, this is zero GPA, right? So if I do the same thing at 130 GPA, a little higher temperature, but much higher pressure, so much more compaction, you see that already the oxygen silicon goes up because you have an SiO6 this time, octahedra, but they are bonded one to each other, so they share oxygens. So a given oxygen in the middle, we'll see one silicon from one side, one to the other. So this can give me a measure of the polymerization of the melt. And then you also see that all the other coordination numbers, what you would expect, go up. Okay, because there is more compaction, this is how the melt accommodates pressure. So let me show you, because I want to go and show you the densities. The trajectories, 0 GPA, 3000 Kelvin, 12 picoseconds. This would be all the silicons. You see that they move. Every single spaghetti in there corresponds to the trajectory of a particular silicon atom during my 12 picoseconds. They don't stay in one place. They go. They move away. ions, they also go away. You see that also this would be my simulation cell, right? This image here is the same as there, and then during my simulation, all the iron atoms move around, and they go over a certain distance, and the square of that distance would give me the diffusion coefficient divided by the time. This would be 130 GPa. There was zero. This is 130. Look what happens when you look at this for 3 picoseconds.
So you said square of the distance, but distance along the tortuous path.
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah, okay, there is a formula behind you. See, over time, how much distance the atoms... It's a mean square displacement, what you need to do. You can sort of correlate it, but it's not just... There are some formulas behind. So the same thing, but high pressure, 130 GPa, 3 picoseconds.
That's very low temperature, isn't it, to make pyrolyze?
Yes, okay, it's a little low, because they really wanted to make a point here that your 3 picoseconds there, you would see your melt as a glass.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you see that your atoms here, they don't diffuse, they just kind of stay around their place, they don't go away. Yes. 3 picoseconds. 8 picoseconds, they start to move, but still this is very sluggish. It doesn't like to go fast and away, it takes a lot of time. You need to go to dozens of picoseconds to actually see this moving, because the diffusion coefficient is very low. And we cannot really crystallize melts like this to obtain a crystal. That's a whole story by itself. We will need million atom sizes to have something that looks in terms of texture like the experiment. There are people in Livermore who did this. Okay, but here we just have a very highly viscous undercooled liquid at 3000 Kelvin. At 5000 Kelvin, where it's really a melt, it's much nicer. But you need to be sure that when you do your statistics, you really have a melt, that you have enough snapshots and enough things to be able to say something at the end. And then again, over the same, you see that even the ions move, but they are still kind of in a glassy-like state. It's too low temperature for this pyrolyte. Okay, the same with magnesium, they are highly more diffusing. Okay, and then density. So with all these different volumes, 3 temperatures, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, blue is the coolest, red is the hottest, and we have the density as a function of pressure. Okay, this would be the melt, no crystals, the pure melt. And we compare this would be the present-day CMB, and we compare the density of this melt with the density of magnesium silicate perovskite. This would be the first crystals that you take out of your melt. And then you see that the crossover is slightly above the CMB. Now, it's true that if you take into account a few percent error bars on both sides, this can go kind of in anywhere, below or above, because they are very horizontal, the slopes are very small. Okay, but if you just look at the numbers we got, the density crossover would be above. So the first, if you form the crystals here at the CMB, they will want to go up, if there is no convection or no steam or nothing. If you form the crystal somewhere here, they will want to go down because of density. Of course, to this you add steering due to the convection, temperature, when they move, they would melt or they would go in size, and so on. So it's much more complicated than just this simple picture. But we managed to put the crossover. Now we continue crystallizing. By the time we reach 30% crystals, you see that the crossover moved upwards to the shallower mantle. So it goes into the middle mantle. Even if you have error bars and everything, you still are somewhere in the middle of your ocean. And then again, of course, the crystals that would form to the right would go up, and the ones from the left would go down. 50% crystallization. This is the moment when you would reach the rheological transition. So you will have so many crystals somewhere here that you block, and you guys know it better, you block the convection because you go into this rheological transition and the whole thing gets stuck. Okay, now this is again magnesium silicates. You would tell me that, well, we already have some iron inside. So we did the same thing. So these are actually calculated points for Bridgmanite, right? I added some iron in it. it gets denser, but not as much as to go to move considerably below the density crossover. So most probably, by this time, the density crossover happens somewhere here in the mid-mantle, around 60-70 GPA. So this would mean that eventually you would separate an ocean here, so melt at the base, and the melt at the in the upper part. Yes, Christopher.
Excuse me, see something maybe interesting, but I don't know if it's an artifact or not. Do you have a kink in the low pressure compressor?
It's just the plot. Yeah. And in the meantime, I have a few longer simulations, and the error bars are just easier to show this because there are too many lines. Right? Okay, and then Maxim helped me figure all this out, right? And then what we said, we imagine. So regardless of how you do and where you start your crystallization, you will always end up with a layer of crystals in the middle. We tried all the possible ways, and the outcome is always the same. You have a basal Mach motion and an upper Mach motion, as long as the depth of your magma ocean is like 1,200 kilometers or something like this. Okay, even if I didn't believe in the magma ocean, the Basel magma ocean when I started to do this. So what we said is that let's say that you start with the crystals here, forming at the base, right? They will raise because they would be buoyantly, negatively, positively buoyant. They will want to go up. And then you will just continue doing this. And after a while, the melt that can be trapped here will go down because it will be heavier, it will be enriched in iron, and just by itself, the density would be larger, will go down. So the result is that you will just continue to do this. And in the end, you will end up with a layer in the middle where it can be like a marshy layer, but through which the convection wouldn't pass. Right, with crystals, some trapped melts in here, and then melt a big ocean, big, few hundred kilometers thick ocean here at the bottom, and another one on top. With a density course over there. Then if we try to have a density, the crystallization starting from somewhere from the middle, we also end up with something like this, with a Basel magma ocean. Like, regardless of how you play with it, you still have your Basel magma motion. Okay, so.
Stefan LaBrosse is happy with this result.
He was very happy.
Who's happy?
Stefan LaBrosse. Yeah, they were very happy. They asked me, why didn't you believe it? I'm like, well.
Can we get major element differentiation?
You can get some, yeah, you would get some.
Stratification.
You can get some stratification. This would be the next. It's coming here. Look, helium, xenon will do. What was the next? I don't remember from the list yesterday. A lot. So yeah, we can learn. Argon, tungsten. Yeah. Because now we have what we need, and I have the melts on the iron side, and I was just struggling to calculate the partitioning of helium, for example, based on this between the two, and it just works with enough patience. So, yes, there was apparently a Basel Mach motion. And then, so the density of the melt and the position of the density crossover is mainly dependent on iron content. Then we see that the coordination increases with pressure. Diffusion is weakly dependent on composition. I didn't show diffusion because I said it's already too much. But yeah, there is not much change in diffusion between the different compositions. They all kind of, and they all fall the same with all the works that Lux did and the other groups as well. Okay, I'm writing that.
Can you create a mantle that looks compositionally uniform with this model?
Oh.
Like what our mantle looks like.
Wait. So you want a solid mantle?
Well, our mantle.
That's a biased statement, Abby.
Seismically, right?
Yeah.
Our mantle, you can't tell compositionally the difference between an upper and a lower.
Composition, seismically.
You can't separate the two.
I mean, that's a completely different story. If you want, yeah, we can talk about thermal elasticity. We can calculate it, and this is the way I would go and do it, rather than starting from a crystallizing melt.
I'm just asking, does this predict that you'll have very large major element differences between a top and a bottom of the...
Not, I don't think necessarily that it will do that, because even if you enter, in the end you crystallize the whole thing, and then you have 4 billion years of convection.
Yeah.
That 4 billion years of convection, you guys should tell me that they mixed quite well things inside. And the isotopes come out quite heterogeneous, quite homogeneous, I suppose, right? More or less. We still have hidden reservoirs, so I agree with you, and that's nice and cool.
Well, one of the more interesting predictions of Lebras's original model of that basal magma ocean was that it would produce major element heterogeneity, right? And at about the right scale length to make LLSVPs, for example, which might very well stick.
Yeah, and probably also, I mean, also if you look at like the final droplets of the Basel magma ocean, if they exist somewhere like in ULVZs or so, they could contain and they could be your hidden reservoirs, because there you can put all sorts of things that wouldn't go in a silicate.
Yeah, so we know there was a magma ocean of some kind, probably, but the problem is we don't have great evidence for it geochemically.
Today.
For Basel. Yeah, because this was for...
On the moon, we see this beautiful evidence, but the Earth is just, if there was one, it's been essentially erased, or we're looking for the wrong signatures.
So what would you look for?
You would look for... Ringwood, till the day he died, maintained there was never a magma ocean, because if there was, you would fractionate some key trace element ratios like hafnium from the rare earth elements due to the perovskite, you know, crystallization. And we don't see that in the upper mantle. We see chondritic relative ratios. So he always, that's what's his argument. But of course, then you could argue, which I think is the argument, that, well, maybe there was this heterogeneity originally, and it's been obliterated because of it's an active planet. And on the moon, it's not. So.
And if I may add on to that, where I think when people talk about fractionation between liquid and crystals, they consider only the effect of the crystals. They've never considered that the melt changes structure dramatically with pressure. So this consideration was based assuming that the melt has a very open core structure, like we know at ambient pressure, and very big trace elements probably behave very differently in a fraction melt. So you, they might not be fractionated.
Well,
I'm not talking about what's in here.
Ringwood was
yes. But tungsten, it seems like this. I can tell, I mean, putting tungsten in that, he's awful. Yeah, just doesn't want to stay in there. And I'm doing this for like 2 weeks now. Just doesn't want to get in the structure.
Same for the...
Find something easier, I don't know. Xenon would be okay.
So, a few months ago, one of your French colleague groups largely reminded me who the authors are. I wrote a paper saying that there was no basal magma ocean.
Oh. Oh, yes. Deniandro, maybe?
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Yes.
It's based on melting experiments.
Yes.
And I guess the difference is presumably the relationship between the melting curve and pressure.
Yes.
An 80 of that, or an isentrope, always intersects the melting curve at higher pressure.
Yes.
Can you comment on those experiments?
Not really.
You have the two scenarios that outlined very nicely in your previous slide. So so Andrel's scenario is the top one.
Exactly. Oh, okay.
And,
yeah.
And our scenario and Lebras's scenario is the bottom one. And that, I thought you went through this very nicely. But even in the Andrel scenario,
you end up still creating a basal magma.
In terms of the solid, did you predict what composition the solid crystals
are? No. So what I did, these were the measurements, experimental measurements. So the experimental measurements, they looked at some compositions. What I did, I know that the moment when I stopped the simulations, I have only perovskite coming out, and I have two compositions, magnesium pure, and then Fe 1/8 or something like that. Probably the composition would be somewhere in between. I took like something that was okay for my simulation size and to get things done.
And you calculated the density of the solids as
yes,
well?
Yes, absolutely. In here, these lines, these points actually, are calculated solids at high pressure and temperature. At the same temperature as this one, so I can compare it temperature and temperature. I didn't go to 5,000 because probably they would melt by that time.
But that's assuming they have the melt and the solid have the same composition.
No. No, no, no. So these these points here, they are magnesium 875, I don't know, at 4,000 Kelvin at several volumes, so several pressures. And then I have the density of the same thing at 3,000 Kelvin. You see that also, if I remember correctly, like this point, maybe they were at very similar volumes, but because of the temperature, the density changed or was something. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.